Welcome back to the Fit for Golf podcast. If you're interested in developing clubhead speed and driving the ball further, this episode is for you. Trey Mullins is a PGA professional based in Tennessee who has dedicated himself to learning about and increasing his own speed over the last few years. The improvements he and his students have made are extremely impressive. I hope you pick up some information that you can put to use in your own training. The all-new Fit for Golf app is nearly here. If you are a current subscriber, keep an eye on your emails. And for those of you who aren't subscribers, there will be announcements on social media in the coming days. Enjoy the episode and let me know if you have any feedback. As always, ratings and reviews are welcome. Trey Mullins, thank you very much for joining me on the Fit for Golf podcast. How are you doing, Trey?
I'm doing great, Mike. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Trey, would you mind bringing the listeners up to speed on your background and what you're currently doing in the golf world?
Yeah, so my name is Trey Mullins. I live in Knoxville, Tennessee. Just a little bit about me. I've been in the golf business for, 9 years now, and really started teaching full-time probably about 3 or 4 years ago, and kind of addicted to speed and learning how to swing it fast and hit it far. So I'm currently at Fairways and Greens in Knoxville, Tennessee. It's a teaching facility, learning facility. We've got about 1,400 members that are just there to practice, no golf course. And it's been really great for me to kind of learn and take my business to the next level and kind of tinker a little bit and experiment.
I found you via Instagram. I don't know how long ago now, but basically just started seeing some of your posts, maybe actually something that Downshift, the pressure board company, may have reposted. And yeah, it was really interesting to see what you were doing. You were obviously making a lot of progress, and we kind of got in touch a little bit and started talking a little bit. And I was trying to learn as much as I could from your posts. You said that you're now addicted with trying to gain speed and figure out what leads to a club moving fast. What led to this interest?
You know, I wish I had some kind of fancy answer or, I guess, coaching aspect, but I just wanted to hit it further, just like every amateur out there. From the time I started playing golf, I was big baseball background, and I was always tiny. High school, I just swung it fast, started that. College, I got pretty quick, had a couple teammates that pushed me pretty hard. They were bigger than I, and I think I was like 135 pounds when I started college. So I eventually put on some weight and started catching up with some of those guys, but I just started working, lost some speed, and wanted to gain that back, and then it happened pretty quickly, and I was like, hey, let's see how far we can take this.
So when did this process start?
It started earlier than what most people see on Instagram. In 2019, I bought Super Speed Sticks, started that program, and basically started trying to hit it as hard as I could, similar to what you see a lot of my posts on Instagram. And my swing was not efficient. I was not in good enough shape, and I actually hurt myself pretty bad. I didn't find out until kind of late 2020 that I had two bulging discs. And so I spent the majority of 2021 just recovering and learning. So,
were they lumbar spine herniated discs? Or
yeah, I had two bulging discs, L4, L5, L5, S1. And it was a lot of pain. Lower back, sciatic area. Entire left leg would go numb, sharp pains. It was no fun. And I knew that I had to go about it in a different way once I started learning a little more.
How long after you started working on your speed did you start to struggle with the injury?
It was so interesting too, because it wasn't even like I was doing speed training. I noticed it getting a little tighter. And probably the summer of 2020, I was playing golf and I teed off with a hybrid for all things, not even with a driver. And it just popped. And at that moment, it went tingly. And the next morning, I couldn't really put my shoes on. So something was definitely wrong. And I was stubborn and tried to stretch and fix it on my own. And eventually, an orthopedic surgeon at the country club I was working at noticed I was in some pain. And he said, hey, come see me. And luckily, he was a close friend. He said, hey, I'm not going to cut on you. I don't even want to inject you. But here's a packet this thick of core and back strength exercises and everything. Do this. And get in better shape. And I did that and then kind of took it to the next level and eventually got in the gym, started to get in better shape and finally recovered, but I was still very hesitant to go about it. So I spent most of 2021 just learning and analyzing all the fastest guys on tour. How can they do it at this speed and as much as often as they do it and not get hurt? And then started looking more into long drive and tried to take little bits and pieces and figure out why was their swings more efficient and not resulting in major injuries along the way as well.
We won't spend too long on the injury because I do want to get into kind of your training and progress, what's been happening more recently. Do you think that the injury to your lower back is something that may have been pre-existing and was building up over time, and then it was the increase in sort of volume and intensity led to a little bit of a breakdown?
Potentially. In college, I had some lower back pain, just a little bit, but we were always doing something. I was one of those guys that was addicted to practicing and hit balls all the time. I lifted as much as I could, just trying to get stronger. And it very easily could have been a small pre-existing injury. And then once I was older and not in as good a shape and started pushing myself way too hard, it flared up and got more severe.
Okay, so moving on to how you've been able to gain speed and just how much, can you give us a little bit of a timeline on when you first started thinking, okay, I want to gain some speed, let's start working on it, maybe pre-injury to when you got injured, how much you lost when you got injured, and the build-up since?
Yeah, so 2019, when I first started pre-injury, I was right around 117-ish on the course, maybe pushing it to 122. And I gained a lot of speed quickly. I got to where I was pretty comfortable at 124, and I'd hit 130. And I was playing kind of that low 120s range most of the year before I got injured. And when I started back 2021, the first thing I did was spend 2 months in the gym, just getting stronger, getting in better shape, gaining some mobility. And when I started my training again, I was probably closer to 114 on the golf course. So luckily, I didn't lose a ton, but I still had lost some, and I was could maybe hit 118. And fortunately, I'm a big believer that if you were fast at one point in time, you can probably gain that back pretty quickly. And over that winter, from winter of 21 to spring of 22, I got pretty comfortable around 124, 125 again, kind of where I was pre-injury, and just some minor aches and pains. I befriended a physical therapist. His name's Paul Michael. He's here in town. And fortunately for me, we traded services. He's a little more expensive than I am for lessons. So I'm coming out on the better end of that deal. But I worked on his swing and he worked on my body. And it made a big, big difference. I felt like I could push myself a little bit harder. So that year, I was pretty comfortable around the 125 range. I'd hit 131, 132 or so in practice, just giving it all I had. And majority of 2022, I didn't have really any pain, any injuries. And going into that winter, took the next step, kind of did the same thing. Gym first, got a little stronger, got to where I was 130 or so comfortable on the golf course, and it hit 140. And now this winter, I've spent a lot of time actually more golf focused in the gym. A guy named Paul Mew, he's in Australia. He won the Australian Long Drive Championship this past year. We connected through Instagram as well. He's built me essentially a long drive gym program. And that's been the biggest thing that's allowed me to push through this next plateau. Last winter, I felt like I was kind of stuck at that 130, 140 range and couldn't really get any faster. And I think my body just couldn't handle it. So this off season, gym, body, fitness has been a big, big focus. And then I've started dabbling more in the long drive equipment, which obviously has given me a little bit more on my top speeds. Just getting used to that, the length of the shaft, the heads and all that. But it's been fun. So I'm comfortably 132 on course. I've hit 148 club speed with a 48-inch driver, and I've hit 211 ball speed. So we're getting there.
Yeah. So you kind of said it quite casually there, but those numbers are starting to really creep up into very impressive categories. So if we summarize there from when, if we just limit it to say a regular length driver, when you started to where you are now, if we say cruising speed on the course and max speeds, what are the differences there?
Cruising speed pre-injury, I was 117, 118.
And how old were you then?
Oh gosh, now I got to do math. 5 years ago, 25.
Okay. And how tall are you and what do you weigh roughly?
5'10". I was about 180 then. Now I'm about 193. I'm starting to gain a little weight. 200's the goal. If I can get to 200, I feel like I can get a little bit more speed. But yeah, I've gained up to about 193. And it's healthy. We're good. But yeah, so I was 117-ish, comfortable, maybe push it to 120, 121. And now I'm with a stock play driver, 131, 132, and I can push it to 138 or so.
Okay, so we're looking at nearly 15 miles an hour of cruising on course speed in 5 years.
Yeah,
like really impressive. And kind of one of the things that stood out to me when I was watching your videos on Instagram is that you didn't look like a giant. You know, sometimes you see someone, you know, who's pumping out crazy speeds and you're like, not that it's not impressive, but, you know, they might be 6'4", 230, and, you know, their arms are hanging down to their knees and you're like, okay, it's very impressive, but it almost looks like a normal swing and the person is just blessed with those, with that frame. But when I was watching yours, it was really clear to see how much progression there had been in your technique. And it was interesting that it was someone who, you know, probably doesn't have the build for crazy high speeds in a stereotypical sense was able to do it. A question that I have is, if you had to try and break down the contribution you got from, you said you started with purely focusing on smashing it as hard as you can. Then you did some work where you were really delving into the mechanics and the efficiency, looking at what the best guys did. And you talked about physical development. It's obviously very hard to isolate, but if you had to think back over the last few years and where the big gains came from in terms of working on smashing it as hard as you can versus, hold on a second, how am I actually moving when I'm doing this? And changing your body, basically, they all intertwine. But I'd love to hear your insight into where you feel like this is where I saw a lot of progress and maybe this didn't help so much or whatever that experience was for you.
Yeah, every time I've seen a big jump, it's been when I focus mostly on mechanics and just getting stronger, just in the gym and making sure that my body could handle it. I'll take that back. I didn't see big jumps, but I felt more prepared for that big jump to where when I started pushing myself for the, just the crazy speed swings and through the sessions, it increased quite a bit. But I think for me, just being able to do that, it was definitely mechanics. That was my biggest issue in terms of the injury, in my opinion. I had very poor mechanics. I hung back on my backside, insane amount of side bend so that I didn't hit it far left. And eventually just the lower back couldn't handle it any longer. Plus I wasn't in the best of shape. So the combination of poor mechanics and not being strong enough to handle it was my downfall. But I think for the listeners and majority of my students, I'm huge on mechanics and just the sequencing of everything. And I've got a few guys that I work with on Skillist that their first message is, I want to get faster. Here's the swings. And I look at it and I tell them, hey, we can't yet. Because if you get faster, you're going to run down my route. And I don't want that to happen to you. So I've almost made it my mission to not only help people gain speed, but to do it the right way and to make sure that it's sustainable. And if we'll have a good conversation, and part of my questions on Skillist are how often do you spend time in the gym? Do you have a program, et cetera, some things like that. And if they don't, then I push them towards that as well. But I'll be very strict with my students, even if they're 16, 17, if they come in and their swing is poorly sequenced, I'll say no, like not yet. We have to spend some time here first, and then we'll go down the crazy route of me pushing as hard as we can, and we'll get some fast swings in. But very, very passionate about that part of it, personally.
Yeah, so obviously that's the correct thing to do when you're thinking of long-term for that player. They might also be good examples of golfers who will get faster without focusing on speed, just as a byproduct of moving in a different pattern. Would you say that's something you've experienced?
100%, especially for the average middle-aged golfer, like mostly, usually doesn't turn very good on the way back. The sequencing is poor. So I'll see 5 to 6 mile-an-hour gains sometimes on club speed just from getting in the right sequence and making sure that we're moving and pivoting correctly. So that already there, yes, we've gained the speed, but it didn't take maybe what I'm putting myself through and what they see. But yeah, you're spot on. A lot of times just the swing mechanics and the sequencing is a huge factor in gaining a little bit of speed there, or a lot.
When you're working on that type of mechanical focus with players or yourself, how much of it would you say is at very slow speeds or without a club and ball, where it's solely just focusing on how my body's moving? Or maybe a better way of the question is, obviously, eventually you want somebody to be able to do these movements at as high an effort level as they can, because that's how we'll be our fastest. Great mechanics with maximum intent. How do you structure the build-up process for someone who has, you know, this inefficient sequence and you want to change the movement pattern? How do you structure that in terms of, okay, I know this isn't what you might have thought of when, you know, we discussed like speed training, you're doing something, you know, that's not very fast at all, and you're not even hitting a ball. Like, how does that look?
My favorite thing in person is to throw somebody on a downshift board and have them try to hit a golf ball. And when they almost fall and the board spins out from under them, I'm like, okay, like now we have to stop, slow down, take the club away and figure out how we can get this board to work the correct way without falling down or even making contact. But for the most part, a lot of work with the downshift board, a lot of work with force pedals. And my favorite thing, just starting out and all of my junior, I have like junior speed clinics where I get a bunch of kids together. I have 5 downshift boards, so I'll line them up and get them on those.
Very, very quickly, sorry to interrupt, because I know there's people listening. Tell us what the downshift board is.
Downshift board, it is a pressure board where it looks like a skateboard, but it's got a little raise, probably 2 inches in the middle, maybe 1.5 inches. Jeff's going to see this and kill me for not knowing. He's going to be upset that I don't know exactly how tall that is. But essentially, wherever your pressure is, lead side or trail side, that board's going to tip a little bit. And for me, I like seeing pressure always precede motion. So I'll have most of my players tip the trail side down before they even take the club away, and then make sure they get that lead side, left side for a right-handed golfer, down before they even complete their backswing. Majority of people, when they hop on one of these and try to hit a golf ball, the left side gets down very late. Because the bottom is wooden, there's really no friction, especially if you're on a mat, you're going to slide pretty aggressively and be lucky to even make contact. And I've seen some pretty funny swings when people first hop on one. But I use it in a lot of my lessons. I use it personally at least twice a week or so within my sessions. And it's usually where I start with most of my speed clients in terms of getting the pressure shifts down. And fortunately, I do have a body track mat now. I purchased that a couple months ago. So not only can we look on camera, but we can have that immediate feedback in person of seeing exactly where that pressure's at and the timing of it in relation on the video. So that's great. But then hopping on the board and learning how to actually move the right way is very critical. And I'll have them completely drop their club, not even pretend they're gripping it. I'll have them put both palms out and essentially pushing away and feeling as we're moving side to side or tipping that board down. And as slow as possible, we'll go tip, palms will face about 45 degrees away from you on the trail side. And then from there, we're trying to move back to the lead side. So freezing at the top, and then again, just slowly going through. No club, not even a grip. When they feel comfortable, and this might take 15 minutes for some players, it might take us a while to do that. So this is more each person's individual progression. When they feel comfortable, I allow them to make their grip and then do the same sequence. I'll let them put a club in their hands, same speed. If it feels good, we'll start to speed up and increase the effort levels. And then eventually, when they can make a good full swing without that board shifting and sliding, we'll introduce a ball. And usually it still shifts and slides a little bit, but they start to get the hang of it pretty quickly. And it's fun to watch. But the amount of times that I've told people have told me there's no way you can take a full swing on that board and not slide, I was like, I promise you can. Like, and then I made a post about that not long ago.
That's what I was just going to ask. So I have that board and I've used it a lot, mostly without a club, and I've never hit a ball on it. But anytime I make a swing or even a backswing and a transition with any sort of speed, the board is definitely spinning and sliding. And I've seen your post where I think you swing at 125 miles an hour hitting driver. So it sounds like you think that's a good litmus test for figuring out if you're moving in an efficient manner.
Yeah, for sure. Especially if you don't have any kind of force plates or 3D data like that. Like, you really can't see pressure. You can look at somebody's mass shift, but it's never the same in terms of I can get way left with my body, but if I'm not pressing into the ground hard enough, there's really no force being applied. There's no true shift. But yeah, if you throw somebody on that board, it's, you can't lie. You can't fake it. So
it sounds then like that you're definitely focused on essentially building from the ground up, thinking of mass pressure shifting, get essentially the global movement pattern cleaned up before you're thinking about things at the hands and wrists and arms, and even like the sequencing of the segments in terms of separation of the pelvis or the torso. It's really how are you shifting that pressure and mass is almost step one.
Yeah, it is. And it's so funny how that is completely shifted from how I used to teach 4 or 5 years ago before kind of diving down this speed path. It's made me focus exactly how you said, from the ground up. If you're not moving your pressures the correct way, then you're not going to get the club to do what you want. It's just going to be a battle that you're not going to win for the most part. And I'll die on that hill.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the potential, I guess, drawbacks or limitations of working with camera all the time.
Yeah.
Is that what we're seeing on camera is a reaction to forces that have happened earlier in the movement. And if you concentrate on the time frame that you're seeing on the camera, it's, you need to go like steps before that to figure out what led to that reaction, which is tough with camera, and it's why you always should have a good coach. Have you had the chance to get on force plates or 3D and get kind of in-depth analysis on those?
I personally have not. I've tried. I've got a couple friends in Atlanta and Nashville that it's just never worked out. We've tried to plan a few times and something comes up. I want my own 3D force plates so bad, but about to have my third child, it's still a little tough. They're not cheap, that is for sure.
The college fund might suffer.
Exactly. Yeah. So they either got to be really good golfers themselves or be really smart. One of the two, if I'm going to buy those, but we'll see. I'm hoping, I'm putting a little bit away each month to hopefully save up. And I've had a couple people tell me that I should wait, and they think that AI is going to come out with something that is going to basically be able to tell us. I don't know how, again, like just to the naked eye, it's so hard to tell what the pressures are. But I mean, it's, computers are so smart these days, who knows, but.
Do you have a system that you would pick if you got to choose out of the kind of highest level force plates available? Have you looked into it enough to get a picture of that?
I have. I mean, obviously Swing Catalyst is hard to beat. I feel like it's the TrackMan of force plates, but I've talked to Tyler with Smart to Move and their 3D plates, and I think they've got a great product. Most likely at this point in my career, if I purchase them, it will be the Smart to Move 3D. The newer ones, not the super high end, but I think they're even around 15,000. So it's a pretty penny. But that would be probably the route I would go. And a couple of my friends have those and they really enjoy them and they work well. So
have you looked into Gasp system?
I have a little bit, not as much as Catalyst and Smart to Move, but I've heard really good things about it as well.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know enough about them, but it's generally the Gasp or the Jewel Swing Cat that I see kind of the top people using.
Yeah.
So you dug into the mechanics a little bit, obviously big focus on how you're shifting your pressure and mass, how you're using the ground. I'm sure people after they listen to this will go to your Instagram and look at your swing. It actually is evident to the naked eye looking at your swing in real speed how much you do use the ground, because you can really see how much your left leg push, or how much your left foot pushes, and then the reaction force pushes it back. We might get into that a little bit, but something I want to talk a little bit about before we move on is, you talked about how you valued improvements in your physical conditioning, and you especially mentioned getting stronger. Are you able to give us a estimation of maybe particular exercises that you've been doing in that time frame that you can tell, well, back in, you know, when I was started this, I was lifting X in this exercise and now I'm able to do Y? Or has kind of the whole training program and exercises you use changed?
Yeah. So when I first started, I knew enough to kind of get myself in trouble or to be dangerous. And it was just solely full body strength. There was no speed workouts incorporated. It was just your normal squat, deadlift, bench, all the above. And it obviously got me in better shape. It got me to where I could handle this, but I don't think it really benefited my speed gains. And within the last, call it 4 months, 5 months, the differences are, I'm a big believer in keeping the reps slow or low, not slow. But if you're pushing for speed, that kind of three sets of five, or depending on the exercise, maybe eight, and complementing that with some kind of fast twitch movement afterwards. So I posted something not long ago on Instagram about combining some cable pulls with some lightweight overspeed training afterwards. So I think just getting that central nervous system firing, having your mind and your body recognize that when it needs to push hard, it needs to push fast as well. Because there's so many guys out there. I mean, we can all picture that one person who's super strong, brute strength, but he's slow as can be. Like, you look at him, he's like, this guy can swing 130, but he's 95 just because he's not quick. And vice versa, you see 10-year-olds that are super quick and can move fast, but they're not strong enough to be able to support the clubhead speed and gain that. So I think I wouldn't say any particular exercises in general, but making sure that you complement strength with speed workouts, whether it be some med ball slams, if you do some weighted pull-ups or something like that, take a really light med ball and just as quick as you can slam on the ground just to kind of mimic that same movement and same intensity. And I think that's been the biggest difference in terms of helping me get quicker, get faster this offseason, as opposed to just stronger and in better shape.
That would generally be referred to as either contrast or complex training.
Yeah.
I think we talked about it a little bit in podcasts before. And what you're talking about there is very common in strength and conditioning circles. We had Andy Galpin on the show a couple of years ago, who's one of the best exercise physiologists and strength and conditioning coaches around. And the way he kind of simplified it was, you have the force velocity curve, and force by velocity is power, which is essentially what we're trying to produce when we swing. So concentrate on those two spectrums of the curve. Do stuff that's really heavy and do stuff that's really fast. And you can do those with similar movement patterns. Yeah, and it's generally easier to do the real heavy stuff with the compound movements and then do the real fast stuff with things like jumps, throws, swings.
Yeah.
I am curious though to try and dig into like how much generally stronger you have gotten in that time frame. I know you said the first winter that it may not have helped much, but I'd be curious if, you know, maybe there still has been huge strength gains which maybe are underpinning some of the changes. And also, I think just the fact you've gained quite a decent bit of muscle mass is probably an important element too.
You know, it's hard for me to judge how much stronger I am. I don't think I've done a max rep since I was in college. And I kind of just threw that out the window. I didn't really care to compare myself. I know there's some importances of knowing what you should be lifting in certain exercises, but I've kind of just listened to my body and what I feel like I can do, judge it off of that. But I don't know if I can put a number to it just with what I've done and how I've went about it, to be honest. But all of my exercises feel way easier and with heavier weight.
What about currently? If you take, say, like a session of 3x5 on some of the lifts that you do, what would be some typical numbers for popular exercises if you're still doing them?
It's even with the squat. I'm going to get some blowback here, as majority of the squats that I do are like box squats, so I don't go all the way down, just so that I can be a little bit more explosive. I want to say it was like 325 sets of five in a box squat, and it felt fairly easy. I'm always by myself too, so I never want to push myself too hard. I don't really have a spotter. I'm very fortunate that the facility that I teach at has a fitness center. Literally, as I walk out of my office, it's there. So I usually stay after closing or go in before we open and get my workout then. Man, so you know, the majority of the stuff, I don't really go heavy weight for the most part. And I just, whatever's on my app that I download or that I plug it all in, it tells me kind of, this is what you did last time. And I try to go a little harder, a little bit heavier. I know Scott Stallings and I are getting to be pretty close and good friends. And I've worked out with him once at his garage, and he pushed me a little harder than what I could handle. I know that. And it was funny. He had some kettlebells and we were doing some just holds, and I was really struggling. I was like, Scott, can I go lighter? He goes, that's the lightest I got, bud. Sorry. Like, you're a whole lot stronger than I am. So maybe I'll bring my own next time. But
yeah, I think from listening to you to describe kind of your progression, it sounds like you're probably stronger than you're giving yourself credit for, and that there has been some decent progression in just your general physical capabilities from the time you've put in and from pushing yourself over that time frame.
Yeah, it feels like it. Like I said, I've just never been one to keep track of that and kind of worry about it. I just do what I'm supposed to do every day and kind of go about my business.
Yeah, it's actually a good point as well, in that one of the most important things in training is to keep the main thing the main thing. So you're using the metric that's most important to you to basically inform you if your training is working or not. And it's also important, especially at certain times, to actually hold back in the physical training a little bit so that you're at full capacity for when you're trying to do like your golf swing and speed work, depending on the time of year and things like that. How much work have you done with speed training systems where, like, I know you mentioned speed sticks at the beginning. Did you use them after that? Have you used other systems, and are you still using them currently?
Yeah, so I used speed sticks up until, I think, 2022 was whenever I got the stack. I'm a big fan of it. I don't use it any longer, and I'll explain why in just a second. But so I've done super speed. I've done the stack. I've got aero swing. I now have the speed toad. So I've tinkered around with a lot of different things. I think grip stick is about the only one that I haven't used personally. And it's one of those things that I've went down this path of, if something can get me one more mile an hour, I'll try it. And it's I've got the Victory insoles that are the carbon fiber, helps you get like a 2-inch more vertical. And it's like, if it gives me a half mile an hour, I think it's worth it. And if anything, it feels nice. It's a little springy. So it's like I can maybe jump up and dunk a basketball or something. But the stack was huge. And it, if anything, for me being super scattered and ADHD, it kept things simple and allowed me to track and kept me going for the most part. And I think I just got to a point, and it's interesting too. I had a little shoulder injury to start this year, and it was while I was doing my stack workout, and I've kind of abandoned all overload swings, and I've done all over speed, lightweight, or wind resistance. So for the most part right now, personally, I'm doing aero swing and speed toed, and not even really their specific workouts, not saying they're wrong, but where I'm doing both and where I'm hitting so many drives as hard as I can, I've tried to limit that to where I'm not pushing myself too hard. And so I've kind of created my own little mini workout with each of those so that I'm not too exhausted. And it's been fun. It's felt better on my body. And the more that I get to know some of these long drivers and really fast guys, and I've had a couple people on Skillist that are 120 plus that want to go to that 130 mark, I've had a lot of people tell me that they've been injured from overload speed training. I think the only person that is above 130 that I've talked to that does it is Drew Cooper. And he basically says that it's because he doesn't really hit that many golf balls. He feels like he can continue to do the super speed. And I think he does ripstick quite a bit and still some heavy weight.
Drew also has a master's in strength and conditioning. He's really, really well trained, and he's also really, really well informed of how to manage his training program in terms of like volume, intensity, when to do it, when to back off, how to warm up, to not keep swinging if something hurts. He's an example of someone who, if somebody's going to do it as best as possible, he would be a good example.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, he's a lot smarter than I in that regard. So I've learned a lot just talking to him. He's always awesome and quick to respond, just simply messaging him on Instagram. But
he's a must follow for anyone interested in speed, Drew Cooper. I've actually got to see him hit balls in person.
Really?
Yeah, in Scott Lynn's garage where he has his swing cat force plates.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny. Scott, he only lives about an hour away from me, Dr. Scott Lynn. So I've gotten to know him a little bit. And he texted me one day asking if I'd be interested in coming up, you know, hitting balls, because I hadn't done it on his force plates. And I said, yeah, I'd love to. So I arrived, brought my clubs,
And when I got there, Drew was just mashing balls into the net. And I was like,
yeah, don't even want to hit now.
So I've got to follow this up. Drew was hitting drivers at like 225 miles an hour ball speed. Looked like he was swinging a pitching wedge. And I was just like, it's amazing. Yeah, great.
It's the smoothest, fastest swing I've ever seen. It's just so effortless. And to kind of what we were talking about earlier, like, he's a pretty big guy.
Oh, yeah. He is very big when you like stand next to him. He is large. He's the perfect kind of trifecta for speed, though. He's really big and strong. He has unbelievably good mechanics. And he's also trained physically, like, really well. So he's kind of done a lot of the... He's basically done everything right in terms of training. And he's also like got a really big frame, which definitely does aid.
Yeah, pretty much the perfect combination. That's for sure. Not for me, my little 5'10 frame. But if I ever get to 225, it's going to look a whole lot harder than Drew. That's for sure.
You mentioned you referenced the sheer number of golf balls you're hitting. Give us a breakdown of your training week. What a typical weekly schedule looks like for you right now. Obviously, it's off season.
Yeah. At the moment, the quantity is quite a bit lower. I'm kind of in a phase of where I'm trying to get stronger. I feel like I've kind of gotten to the point to where I don't know if I'm physically strong enough to go any faster than what I am now. So for the most part, it's 2 to 3 times a week. And with my speed sessions, so to speak, I'm still trying to work out 5 at least. And, it's one of those things where I listen to my body really well. Some days I'll hit 80 balls and feel exhausted. And then one day I'll hit 200, but I would say on average, I'm right around 125 or so, driver swing,
full speed,
driver swings,
full effort in one session.
That's warming up, hitting some irons, working my way up. I do my little speed primer now to where, I've started doing a weighted ball throwing program. And I do my arrow swing and then the heavy pulls along with my speed toad. So some really fast over speed swings. And then I go into my max sessions afterwards. And yeah, I probably average around 125 or so of full speed max.
After all your warm-up stuff.
After, yep.
Yeah, so that's a high volume. That is, how did that progression build up over time in terms of volume? Because I don't want a listener to hit 125 drivers tomorrow.
Do not start there. So I was really bad the last 2 golf seasons when I was playing. I slacked off on my speed training. I started teaching a lot. I've got little ones. And I was really focusing on playing. I was trying to play at a fairly high level. And so I spent all of my extra time short game putting, actually playing golf. So when I started back, probably in November, because the national assistance was that first week of November, and I didn't want to do anything until then. I could maybe take 25 swings max before I was exhausted. And it's just slowly progressed. And again, like, I'm big on listening to my body, and when I'm done, I'm done. And eventually I got to where I could go 40 and 50 and 60, and then now I've worked my way up to that 125, potentially 200. Just got carried away the other night. It was last week. And I'd hit over 200 balls max, and I looked down, I'd been going at it for almost 2 hours, and it's like 11 p.m. And what's crazy is I still felt pretty good. Like, I was still hitting like around 140 club speed and 200 ball speed every time. It's like, I gotta go home. My wife's gonna kill me. It's late. So there's some days where I feel good, and I think I can just keep going. And but for the most part, I think that 125 is a good average number for me at the moment.
If you hit 125 balls at max speed, how long does it take you before you're able to get back up to those speeds? Like, if you went to try and do that the next day, I'm assuming you'd be slower. There would be some fatigue there, is what I'm assuming.
Yeah, and that's why I've kind of dialed back a little bit. When I was averaging kind of mid 130s with the max swings, it wasn't as hard on my body, and I felt like I could do it 3 or 4 times a week. But where I've gotten quite a bit faster, and I'm, for the most part, averaging around 140 and near the end of the session, 142, 143 club speed, it's definitely harder on my body. When I wake up the next day, my shoulders are sore, my core is sore, and I know that that's kind of my sign that my body's not quite ready for this. So it's at least 2 days rest, 3 days rest, So I had a little session last night, and then a good friend of mine, Nick Vorbeck, who's on the long drive tour, he's going to come up Saturday. I'll probably squeeze a little mini session in, maybe hit 50 balls tomorrow, and then save it for Saturday so that we can kind of push each other. And he's quite a bit faster than me, so maybe I'll get some adrenaline going and chase him.
Do you use anything to try and assess or monitor fatigue apart from like how you're feeling? Do you use any tests or anything like that?
No, for the most part, the only thing that I look at before, I would look at my club speed, and I always told myself if I dropped below 3 of my average, I would stop. And I'm pretty strict with my students in that, but I've kind of gotten to the point where I guess I'll go back to high school. I'm so competitive, and I ran track all through high school, and even though I wasn't in the best shape, I did the 800 and it was exhausting, but it didn't matter how tired I was. I would push myself that last 100 meters and I threw up after every race. And it's kind of carried over to the speed training to where I would say the last 25% of my speed sessions are just pure adrenaline. So my body is exhausted, but my speeds are still there. So I have to really be careful that I don't push it too hard and cause some injuries there. But and it's one of those things too, that I don't really have many aches and pains anymore, unless it's just the next day and I'm sore from it, which is normal for me. But I always feel like if nothing hurts and if I'm staying at that speed, keep going. So usually it's just that it's 10 p.m. or 11 p.m. and it's just time to go home is my sign. But I don't really use anything in particular. It's more just kind of how I feel.
Yeah, that trade-off is an interesting one of how much to do in terms of getting more benefit as you ramp up the volume,
yeah,
versus increasing the chance of developing an overuse injury. And that goes for any type of physical training or sport. Like it's a really tough question. And what's definitely true and is disappointing, but we can't get away from it, is that the more advanced we get, the harder and smarter we have to train while getting less out of it.
Correct.
You're really trying to milk mini gains. So Yeah, that's a tough one. But I guess on the flip side, what's great for probably most of the people listening is that they're nowhere near as far along on that path as you. So they can have transformative gains in terms of their golf game with probably like 15 balls 3 times a week, which I've seen time and time again.
That's where I usually start everybody, is somewhere between 15 to 25 balls 2 to 3 times a week. And if they do that, and I've seen a lot of your stuff with Jaeger and Ben Martin, in terms of a lot of these good players have it in them. They're just terrified to swing hard and they just don't realize it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, something, it gets more important as you get more advanced. And we're actually lucky a little bit in that when we're speed training, we have a radar that gives us really accurate feedback. But the idea of auto-regulation, which is basically a fancy term for, rather than having, and I think this again gets important as you get more advanced and you get more experienced, is rather than having a set ball count, for example, 3 times a week for the next month, I'm going to hit 50 balls. You can use your radar to regulate your sessions in terms of when might be a good day to push it and do more. If you're seeing high speeds and you're feeling good,
yeah,
and you've gotten to your arbitrary ball count of this much, that might be a day when you decide, hey, like things are going well here, let's keep going. And you might make some progress. On the flip side, if you're a quarter of the way or a third of the way through your balls and you can clearly see that the speeds just aren't there, that's probably a good sign that it's a day where, hey, let's back off. I'm clearly not recovered from my previous training, or I'm tired because I had a bad sleep or whatever. You're probably not going to make any progress and maybe just dig yourself a bigger hole in recovery. Is that kind of something similar to what you'd be looking at with your sessions?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's probably why I stopped at that 80 ball mark in my last session, is it just wasn't there. I think I hit, and it was interesting, I hit like 142 very early on, and maybe my 7th or 8th swing. And I got really excited and it just slowly started to drop and I got pretty tired. And I'm big on telling my students, don't train slow. If you're going to sit there and hit 50 golf balls, 5 slower than what you potentially can, your body's just getting used to moving slower. And it could develop a bad pattern instead of kind of having the positive effect.
I think that's a great point. And I also think that's when it might be a good time to focus more on the mechanics.
Uh-huh.
Like you were talking about, it's like you don't want to, say, miss a practice session because you only have so much time in the week. But if you're planning on speed and you're like, the speed's not there, you can still get in good work, but maybe focusing on how you're moving, like you touched on earlier. And then the flip side of it is you can just dig yourself a bigger recovery hole that takes longer to get out of. And you're not just having a bad session today. You're probably affecting the one that you're supposed to have in 2 or 3 days time that you could, you know, save the energy and recovery resources for.
For sure.
Something that fascinates me with other long drive competitors I've talked to is for how long during a speed session and how deep into the ball count they can go and still see increases in their speeds. What sort of trends do you see? I know you do a really, really thorough warm-up and priming session, which is definitely the way to go. It's on your, I think it's pinned to your Instagram. It's definitely on your Instagram. So I recommend people check that out. But from, let's say, ball one to halfway through the session, what's the progression like in terms of speeds? Are you jumping in pretty much at you know, a couple of percentage of your peak for the session? Or does it take a while for your, you know, self to really, really get coordinated and see the speed spike?
Up until maybe a month ago, it always took me a really long time to hit my fastest speeds. And dating back to last year, the first time that I broke 200 ball speed, I think was on my 150th swing. And I was, again, physically exhausted. And I just kept going because I was like, I got 200. Let's do it again. And it kind of carried over into this year. And every time that I was getting close to 200 or getting close to a new record, it was very late in my session to where I knew I was tired. But obviously that's in there. And I had a really good conversation with Ryan Gregnall about more the mental side of it and separating things of, it's really hard for a good player to kind of shut that off and not focus on technique and swing and contact and direction and solely look at speed. So this might sound corny, is a lot of times now when I know that I'm going to try to push for a faster speed, I'll almost kind of meditate for a little bit and just kind of relax and think about a lot of my fastest sessions and kind of get that just programmed into my brain before I go through my warmups. And since then, it's come a lot faster. And I've started hitting some of my faster speeds within my first like 10 or 15 swings, as opposed to ball 100 of getting ramped up. And I feel like I can maintain pretty well for a long time. And like you said, a lot of it does depend on rest and workouts and what's gone on through the day. Like if I give 8 lessons and then work out and it's 9 p.m., I don't expect a lot. I might try it a little bit. And if I see that the speeds aren't there, we'll focus on the sequencing, the mechanics. But a lot of it is very mental, I think, for me personally, of getting to those faster speeds early on. And it takes really not playing golf. I haven't played a round of golf on a golf course since November. And all of my golf has been in a TrackMan for the most part. So even the driver swings I make in those TrackMan rounds, I'm giving it just about all I got just to kind of keep that focus there. And obviously it doesn't work out every time, but I think it's helped with the speed training, and I'll eventually get back into the golf course here very soon. But I'm trying to squeeze out every little bit I can before I start.
We're going to move on to your golf next. To finish up on your speed training stuff, I think you're doing a lot of these sessions pretty late at night.
Most of them are very late at night.
What sort of time were we talking about?
Oh, so fairways and greens where I work Monday through Thursday closes at 8. So if I do any speed session, I wait until we close because I usually crank up some music and I get kind of loud and yell at myself sometimes. So I don't want to do that while there's people watching. They might judge me a little bit.
It's also loud no matter what you do if the ball speed's 200 miles
true.
An hour.
Yeah.
Indoors.
We had a Callaway ball fitting yesterday and I snuck in when we were done and hit a few. The Callaway rep was walking around the corner and he heard one hit the screen. He goes, "That's Trey, isn't it?" I'm like, "Yeah, that's me." We're in a big warehouse, so it echoes essentially. And every time I hit a ball, it's pretty loud, or especially whenever I have like Nick down. Nick swings at 150, high 140s. We got 219 ball speed not long ago with him, and his are a little bit louder than mine. He's luckily this time he's coming down Saturday. We close early on Saturdays, so we're going to have our session at 6 p.m. So maybe get out there in a decent hour. But yeah, anywhere I'll usually work out first and do my speed session afterwards. So sometimes I don't start my speed session until 9 p.m.
You're doing a full workout and then your speed session?
A lot of times. It depends on what I'm trying to do. If I'm trying to push for a PR, then I'll do it. But a lot of the workouts that I'm doing now where it is strength plus speed, my body just feels so ready to go. And it's nice.
Yeah, there's a sweet spot there where you're getting really, really well primed, but probably avoiding like fatigue in the sessions. I'm guessing you're not grinding out the last couple of reps of a set or getting a massive pump and your arms and legs feeling like jelly.
Correct. Yeah. Don't tell Paul, but I might skip a couple here and there if I know I'm going to push hard.
Yeah, we'll have to look into that program at another time for definite.
Yeah.
You haven't just been smashing balls into a screen. You've also been playing competitive golf and you had a really good season last year. Can you talk to us about the level of golf you're playing, how you balance trying to gain all the speed and bringing it to the golf course and kind of how it's influenced your game?
Yeah, last year was good. And I ended up winning our assistant player of the year. Qualified for the National Assistance Championship and had a good year. I think my scoring average was right just above 70. And it's wild. Everyone tells me that I don't need this much speed for the golf course, but I feel so much more in control. For the first half of the season, I was close to 70% of my fairways. And that was crazy. It dropped quite a bit. I think I ended up around 60. But my goal was 50%.
At what sort of ball speeds you had on the course, roughly?
I want to say last year it was probably high 180s, 88 to 190.
That's essentially like, now I know the golf courses are different, but that's essentially top of the PGA Tour rankings in ball speed, which would be like high 80s. There's sometimes a player gets into the low 190s, but there's only ever a handful of players, like definitely less than 10, that are over 183 or 184 every season. The PGA Tour average for fairways, I think, is 59%. So you're basically at PGA Tour average in fairways, but your PGA Tour average ball speed is 173. So you're about 15 miles an hour ball speed, about 30 yards above PGA Tour average, roughly, in distance, while hitting comparable amount of fairways. So that is definitely a big influence on your game. Tell us, like, is that better than you used to drive it before? Like, how has the speed training changed how well you drive it on the course, not just how far you hit it?
It is way better than it used to be. I keep track of my stats pretty well. I use Swing U. I partner with them as one of their coaches, so I can sign up my students under Swing U also. But I never tracked prior to this year, but I always struggle with big numbers. I would have a double in almost every round I played. And I'd have a triple or higher every third round, most likely. And last year, I started tracking my stats in February, and I didn't make a double bogey in practice or in tournament play until June, which was crazy for me. And I think I only ended up making maybe 6 or 7 for the entire year within tournaments, and most of those came down at the National Assistance the last day because I was out of it and just kind of had fun. But it's wild just how much more control I have. And I attest that too, that not only in golf, but any kind of object, the faster that it moves, it's going to work on a more efficient plane and a more singular plane. So there's less that can go wrong. As long as I have good base control, my path doesn't vary very much. So I know what my ball flight's going to do. I used to miss it left so often, combination of an inefficient plane plus inefficient weight shift. I would hang back, face would have way too much time to rotate, and it was scary how far left I could hit it prior to last year, even with some of the gains that I'd had the two previous years. But it's crazy how much more confident I am off the tee. But we play a lot of short golf courses too. Like, we never play beyond 7,000 yards, which in a way frustrates me. But I can pull out a 4-iron and fly at 250, whereas most guys are flying their driver around there that I compete against in our Tennessee PGA events. So even if the driver's not working, I can hit a 4-iron or a 2-iron and still be up there with most of the guys and play the golf courses that we play.
That's what I was just going to ask. How I know it obviously depends on the course, but are you still getting to use driver a lot, would you say? Do you try to use it as much as possible? Or is there a lot of times you're like, there's nowhere to land it here, you know?
I'm pretty aggressive, but I'm not stupid, I guess to say. It's been my goal is being smarter this past year and then managing my way around courses. But I've always kind of lived and died about trying to get as close to the green as possible. The one downside of my distance gains is I have a much larger awkward wedge range of like my 50% kind of half 58 degrees, like 70 yards now. So that 30 to 70 yards is kind of weird. And I've spent a lot of time trying to learn how to produce consistent shots from there. So if I can get it inside of 30 yards, I do my best. And if not, then I'll lay it back. Again, like we don't play a ton of hard golf courses. There's a couple on our schedule that are very old school. They've been around for a long time, a lot of dog legs that I got to kind of plot my way around. And I have fun with that too. I'm super creative. My college coach said that I was the only person he ever saw that when he was in the trees, the first place I looked was up to figure out where the holes were. So luckily I'm a little smarter now, but off the tee, I can kind of get creative a little bit and hit some interesting shots.
Yeah, I think having some awkward gapping with your wedges is not the biggest problem to have, though.
Yeah.
As long as you're still able to make decent contact, it's like,
yeah,
if you're between 30 to 70 yards, a mediocre shot is going to be a lot closer to the hole than a really good shot from 120 or 150 or whatever it may be in the vast majority of scenarios. So something I'm telling golfers all the time is that if they are really interested in increasing speed past a quick initial burst, which I think is easy once we get started just from some intent, they need to be working on their mechanics, as we touched on.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you coach people on via the Skillist app.
Yep.
So a lot of people listening will be familiar with remote coaching. Some won't. Can you explain how that process works? And if people listening to this want to work with you through Skillist, if you're available, and what they need to do?
Yeah, of course. I started maybe 3 months ago, 4 months ago on Skillist. And it's a pretty interesting app. So you create your own profile and you can go on and search for your coaches. It actually asks you a few questions if you don't know who you want to work with. And it'll try to match a coach for you. It's almost like Tinder or Hinge for golf coaches and students. But if you know who you want to work with, you can easily search their name and find them. On my Instagram profile, I have my Skillist link in my bio, so you can go there pretty quickly and find me. But yeah, I'm always taking new students, and it's been an interesting learning curve working through online and virtually. But I send so many questions and have them record certain videos from certain angles, a couple that are unique, one that's unique that I get some weird questions about, but it's important for setup to me. But I think as long as I can get all of those questions answered, I can give you very much close to what I can give you in person.
So is the main thing for people just a phone and a tripod to take video? They're kind of the two main criteria to be able to do it successfully, correct?
Yeah, for sure. And if you are looking to gain speed, if you have access to some kind of radar, it's going to help quite a lot too, just to be able to judge your progressions and see how you're moving along. But yeah, a tripod, a phone, and if you can get into a TrackMan once a week or any kind of launch monitor once a week or so, it'll be very helpful.
Excellent. And just to finish up then, Trey, can you let people know your handles on whatever social media platforms you're on, if you have a website, basically where they can find you?
Yeah, so all of my handles are at Trey Mullins Golf, and it's TREMULLINS Golf. So my Trey is spelled a little awkward, so it gets confusing. But and on Skillist as well, I think I'm the only Mullins. I looked at that the other day. So if you just type my last name, I'll pop up pretty quickly.
Excellent, Trey. Thanks a lot. I really appreciated the info. I'm sure the listeners will learn a lot. And we might have to review in 6 months' time or a year's time and see how far you've gone in that time frame.
Yeah, we'd love to. Hopefully it's 150. That's the goal by the end of the year. 150 and 220.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Trey.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.